Welcome to the keynote stage. So my name is Mark Walsh. I'm the founder of this conference and part of the leadership team with Daniela and Manel. We have got quite a feast, quite a treat in store for you. The main stage doesn't have all the top names on. Some of them are spread out for various logistical reasons, but there are some awesome presenters on this stage. This stage is also sponsored by Alain Stefani. When we first had the idea of getting sponsors, I basically said, I won't take anyone as a sponsor unless I love what they do, because otherwise it doesn't have any integrity for me. I didn't know who Alain Stefani was, but I met her in Berlin. Someone said, oh, she's an intimacy teacher, she's an ex-sex worker, best-selling author in Germany. And I said, okay, well, I'll meet her. And I met her. And as soon as I met her, I felt at ease. I felt like, wow, this is a person who's playful, but also a deep listener. This is a woman who's a real leader. Since I've seen her work with people in very, you know, around trauma, around intimacy, around very difficult areas, men and women, I've come to regard her as a friend, actually. Like, I love her. So go to her website and check it out. It's Alain, I-L-A-N, Stefani, S-T-E-P-H-A-N for November, I. AlainStefani.com. There's an offer there called Love and Rage, which is as juicy as it sounds. You'll also find links in the descriptions for the videos below.
Okay, let me introduce Ken Wilber. So this man is an absolute legend. He is perhaps America's greatest living philosopher, author of many, many books, particularly his Theory of Everything. He is just one of the smartest men I've ever met, and actually super loving too. Ken is someone who's been a big influence on this conference and how we think and how we do what we do. He was a highlight of the 2018 conference. I'm very happy to welcome him back. So Ken, welcome.
How are you?
Actually good. It's been stressful, but as we move towards the end of the conference, very good.
He's doing well.
Yeah, doing well.
How are you? Well.
How are you?
Oh, I'm just fine, thank you.
Okay, so the topic for today is, are we evolving as a species, or is things getting worse? Is it getting better or worse, basically, is our topic, right? So over to you for the presentation.
And...
ready to go.
Ready to go?
Ready to go.
Ready to go. All right. Is the world of 2020 moving forward or backward? Is it evolving or devolving? There are strong believers on both sides of that fence, and I think we can find reasons for both of those views. Let's start with the believers in the devolution side of the equation. There are a large number of believers who maintain that the entire modern world is badly broken and is steadily running downhill. Specifically, those are those who strongly believe that America in particular and the entire Western world in general are rotten to the core, marked intrinsically with sexism, racism, ethnocentrism, homophobia, transphobia, xenophobia, misogyny, and all manner of inherently horrible attributes. They believe the Western world overall is a tyrannical patriarchy marked by male domination and oppression and laced with white supremacy. It's believed that America in particular was founded upon racism, and it still has an epidemic institutional or systemic racism running throughout it, top to bottom. This view therefore sees America as undergoing a continuing devolution. The future is nothing but downhill for America and the Western world, continuing their racist and sexist pathways with little or no hope of any genuine evolutionary or self-improving currents. This view is often referred to as identity politics, since one's overall group identity is held to be the most important thing about a person, either your sex or gender or race or other mutable characteristics that you are born with and have no chance of changing. In a sense, this is an odd choice of identity, Since this view very much believes in the importance of activism or protesting or virtue signaling, that is, maintaining that a particular group which is being protested should instead adopt the virtues that are being signaled by the protesting group. But when one's virtues are determined by one's birth, there's really no chance you can change these physical attributes, such as sex or race, any more than you can change the color of your eyes or your physical height. Nonetheless, the protesters insist that all that remains for culture at large is a further devolution of society itself, unless the protested group at least agrees with the protesters and adopts some sort of identity politics. Otherwise, it's nothing but a continuing downhill trip for that society, a continuing trip of devolutionary downfall. The problem with this devolutionary view is the absolutism with which it is held. America, for instance, is held to be deeply and totally racist, and from its very beginning. The New York Times, for example, has started something it calls the 1619 Project, whose core idea is that America was not founded in 1776, but in 1619, which is the date that the first slaves were brought to America. It's been downhill ever since. So in the 1619 Project, the Times only publishes articles that strictly maintain that point of view. Of course, slavery has been present in virtually every culture the world over, and going back thousands of years. The thing that most defines slavery in America is that America is the first and only nation that fought a war to actually end slavery. The problem with such epidemic and absolutistic ethnocentric views is that they see everything as being negative. These views have a great deal of difficulty in seeing anything good about America or the West in general. Therefore, they tend to see no real evolution at all, just an unending devolutionary tomorrow. It's not that they will disagree with all evolutionary facts if they are directly confronted with such facts. It's that they would never bring up such facts on their own, since any sort of genuine evolution is not possible for such an ethnocentric culture as this one. Thus, any account of the West basically focuses on just the negatives that essentially can be found in any culture. None of the positives or good qualities or evolutionary advances are even mentioned. Thus, for example, take an extraordinary fact, such as the reality that in just the last two decades, the world has itself eliminated almost 50% of its overall poverty. Throughout most of its history, the world has stood at over 90% poverty all round. The overall world today stands at a stunning 10% poverty, from 90% to 10%. This is a genuine and astonishing evolution if ever there was one. But don't expect to hear this from the devolutionary camp, who keep mumbling nothing but how horrid the Western world is. So we want to acknowledge that there are still some genuine areas of racism and sexism in the Western world, but overall, they've been decreasing. Evolution is very real, and it dominates most forms of growth processes wherever they occur. Again, it's not that the devolutionary view has no merit or truth to it at all. There is a sense in which America does have some existing degrees of various sorts of ethnocentrisms, racism and sexism and misogyny. The reason that it does is simply that all people are born at the lowest rungs of development, and they need to grow and evolve from that point forward. Moving from stages of development that start out being egocentric, or identified merely and solely with one's own organism and its limited and narcissistic viewpoint, to stages that are group-centered or ethnocentric, identified with only a particular group, and thus indeed are ethnocentric, racist or sexist or some such, and from there to stages that are finally world-centric or universal, with an identity that treats all people fairly, regardless of race, color, sex, or creed. And thus are stages that finally overcome all sorts of ethnocentric prejudice and bigotry. These, of course, are the stages that we want to attain. But it does take work, and not all people by any means reach these highest stages of human development and overall evolution. But these higher stages of human evolution are indeed the general direction that human development is headed. And aiming for this general higher direction is indeed one of the main reasons that human growth and development in general is in fact headed towards higher stages of evolution. But the failure of humans to make it to world-centric stages and remaining stuck at lower stages of egocentric and ethnocentric stages of development, this is the major cause that there are still lower prejudiced and bigoted pockets of development in cultures worldwide, including America. The cure for this, of course, is increasing evolution. And in general, we can expect to see that evolution will indeed continue into the future, as growth and development in general continues to head in that higher direction. So I'd like to mention at least three areas where we can expect to see evolution continue. And indeed, it already has moved considerably forward in all of these areas. The first is genomics, which is the study of the human genome or genetic material. We have already just mapped the entire genome. So today we know its overall composition. That is, we know the sequence of amino acids in the overall sequence of nucleic acids in the human nucleus. This means we now know the map of the overall human genetic material. We're already seeing that evolution continues as we start to actually alter the sequence order of that material, thus altering the very genetic inheritance of human beings. This means, among many other things, that we can now alter our genetic inheritance. Since most diseases have some sort of genetic grounding, we are learning how to cure illnesses such as cancer and heart disease, which is a genuine evolution. Further, since the very aging process itself has genetic markers, we will very soon be able to slow or reverse human aging, a stunning evolutionary advance. This will likely start by simply advancing the average age of a human being so that at the end of this generation, most people will be living to be around 140 years old or so. Experts believe that eventually this could indeed expand to hundreds and possibly even thousands of years of life. This in itself will demand a large number of other evolutionary advances, psychological, emotional, cultural, and spiritual, simply to be able to adapt to these major and profound changes. I believe all of those evolutionary advances will be delivered, a topic we'll return to in a moment. Another area where we see evolution occurring, and an area where it is already occurring to a substantial degree, is that of robotics. Robotics is presently being applied to areas that do not demand a great deal of mental creativity or pattern recognition. So areas from assembly line work to paralegal professions, to simple accounting, to medical diagnostics. It's estimated that already around 40% of jobs in America have been replaced by robotic machines, a number that will get larger and larger as the field continues evolving. This is another example of how other fields will have to evolve with this one if we are to continue our present lifestyle, particularly in fields including sociological, cultural, and financial, such as new ways to pay citizens a salary, for example, as work is continually done for humans by robotics. It appears, in fact, that robotics will likely get rid of work entirely. Some people lament this, seeing work as a useful way to provide a person with necessary meaning in life. Of course, one of the evolving paths of society will likely be a person being able to work if they want to, and selecting a job that they enjoy and appreciate and are good at. But future evolution might indeed make that a completely voluntary choice for humans. This would go in the positive evolutionary column because, since the beginning of human life on this planet, work has generally been viewed as a curse. It was, after all, what Adam and Eve were condemned to do when they were expelled from Eden. Thus, making work voluntary would indeed be something of a positive evolutionary advance. Most of these evolutionary advances depend in part on the evolution of the third major area I want to mention, which is artificial intelligence, or AI. AI itself has been evolving rapidly, following as it does something called Moore's Law, which simply states that most forms of AI are evolving forward at an exponential rate. Exponential advance is extremely rapid, since each stage doubles the speed of its predecessor. This can be deceptive, and it can produce very startling results. Take a simple example of a speed that doubles with each step. Say you take a checkerboard, for example, and you double the number of grains of rice in each succeeding square. So you'd have one grain of rice in the first square, two grains in the second square, four in the third, 16 in the fourth, and so on. By the time you filled the first half of the board, you will have an amount of rice that would make up an average size rice field in today's world. By the time you get to the last square on the board, you will have a rice field that is larger than all of the rice fields ever grown on the entire planet in all of history. That's a lot of rice, considering you only started with one grain. But that's what happens when you move forward at an exponential rate. So artificial intelligence is evolving forward at an exponential rate. This is one of the reasons we are seeing so much advance in AI in the last decade compared to the amount that it was occurring a few decades ago. And we can expect to see that exponential rate of evolution to continue in coming years. One of the major advances that experts are expecting is the emergence of what is called artificial general intelligence. This is opposed to the type of AI that exists today, which is sometimes called artificial narrow intelligence. Narrow intelligence is intelligence operating on just one field, such as a particular sensory field or a field that works with just one basic pattern recognition, such as a chess game or a language translation program. But artificial general intelligence operates on many different types of pattern recognition or many types of intelligence, and all at once. The human brain, for example, is a type of general intelligence, since it can operate on many different fields at the same time: mathematical, linguistic, cognitive, emotional, and so on. The emergence of an artificial general intelligence, experts maintain, would be the emergence of an intelligence that would be able to match and eventually outperform human intelligence across the board. And this would indeed change everything. It would be such a monumental evolutionary leap forward that it would likely be able to outperform humans in almost every area of existence. This would result in everything from eliminating work entirely for humans to eradicating virtually all illnesses, which would expand human lifespans to hundreds or even thousands of years, to creating a type of utopian society on Earth. Of course, some experts believe that this could instead mark the end of human life. An intelligence which was that evolved could simply reproduce itself at a rate that made it massively dominant in self-survival skills, and it would simply out-survive all possible competitors, including all human beings. If this happened, it would simply go down as one of the most highly evolved of any sort of life form, pointing again to a highly successful evolutionary advance, at least in general cosmic terms. I personally don't think it will turn out that bad. I think more that it will head in a utopian direction. But it does show how many experts there are that keep thinking in evolutionary terms. With all this evolution going on, what about seriously negative directions of future development? How about climate change, for example? Surely that's headed in the wrong direction. Well, it is. But it's important not to exaggerate how negative actual climate change is. If we look, for example, at the amount of global warming that is occurring, according to the United Nations Climate Panel, known as the IPCC, and this is, by the way, the climate panel that just came out with the Paris Accord, which is the agreement that President Trump pulled us out of, and an agreement that has been signed by every nation on the planet, except for America. But this is the result of the UN conference that was recently convened explicitly to address climate change and was attended by virtually all nations of the world. And all of them, except again America, signed the agreement that came out of it. But according to that UN body, that is, according to the IPCC, in about 50 years, or by 2070, climate change will cost the world an average of between 0.2 and 2% of the GDP. 2% of the GDP is far from the extermination of the human race. But the way that many people view climate change is that it does mark the end of humanity, and within around 12 years or so. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, for example, just made exactly that claim. But the best of the world's climate scientists, brought together by exactly the United Nations in the IPCC, disagree. Losing 2% of a nation's gross domestic product is a definite cost, but it hardly amounts to human extinction. 2% is 2%. And by the way, the same United Nations also estimates that by 2070, global human income on average will have gone up considerably more than 2%. So even with ongoing climate change, evolution will continue in an overall positive direction, at least according to the United Nations. With all of this increasing evolution, or what all of this increasing evolution seems to mean, is that evolution is a powerful and widely present force in the universe. In integral theory, we often call it Eros, but whatever we call it, it does seem to be an incredibly widespread force in the overall universe. In integral theory, we talk about several dimensions that are present throughout the universe. We refer to them as states, levels, lines, shadows, and quadrants. We find that evolution is present in all five of those dimensions. So it produces phenomena that we call, respectively, waking up, growing up, opening up, cleaning up, and showing up. The word up in each of those dimensions refers to the evolutionary component of that dimension. So waking up refers to the dimension of states and the fact that there are states of consciousness that humans can wake up to, such as enlightenment or awakening, higher states of existence that disclose profoundly deeper or higher states of being that human beings can evolve towards or wake up to through meditative or spiritual practices. That's waking up. The dimension of levels refers to levels of development or growing up that humans can evolve through, such as the levels we already mentioned of egocentric, ethnocentric, and world-centric. Those are all levels of growing up. Opening up refers to the fact that humans have multiple intelligences or multiple lines of development, and each of those lines evolves to the same general levels of development, opening up to higher levels in their own being. And in this overall growth, things can indeed go wrong at each level or stage of development. This will generally create a broken or fractured psyche or self-sense, which represses and splits off various unconscious shadow elements for which various psychotherapy treatments have been discovered, which involve ways to unite the broken self-sense with the split off shadow material, resulting in a cleaning up of the self, uniting the broken and limited self-sense with a split off shadow material. And that's cleaning up. And showing up refers to the fact that human beings have available to them all of these various dimensions, including subjective or psychological dimensions, objective or biological dimensions, inner subjective or collective cultural dimensions, and inner objective or social dimensions. These four basic dimensions are often called the four quadrants, and the aim is to include or show up for all four of those dimensions if one wants a truly whole or inclusive life, and that's showing up. The waking up, growing up, opening up, cleaning up, and showing up dimensions all have an up aspect to them, which means they all tend to move in an up or evolutionary direction. In other words, the universe has a dimension of Eros built into it. It moves in an evolutionary direction, from quarks to atoms, to molecules, to cells, to organisms. And the up direction or Eros or evolution continues in organisms too, which is why human beings continue to demonstrate evolution and have ever since they emerged on this planet. Of course, the fact that the universe has an inherent Eros or evolutionary drive to it doesn't mean that every single moment must be an evolutionary moment. There are ups and downs in the universe. But it does mean that evolution is an inherent possibility of the cosmos, and it acts as a general ground drive present potentially in all of the universe. The universe does undergo constant change. And one of the directions inherent in that change is a move in the direction of evolutionary unfolding, a move driven by Eros or evolution itself. So both evolution and devolution are intrinsically present in the universe. And the idea is to look for both of them in any change that occurs. This certainly includes any change that occurs in human beings. And this means any change that might occur in America too. So while we do want to look out for any negative or devolutionary forces present in America, we also want to keep an eye out for any positive or evolutionary forces as well. This certainly includes the area of evolution that I've outlined, plus any others that we might spot, of which there are many. So in 2020, is America moving forward or backward? Is it evolving or devolving? And the answer is both. But this definitely includes looking for and acknowledging the many positive or evolutionary directions that this country is moving, and not selectively choosing just the negative or devolutionary directions that are also occurring. Activists or protest movements, of course, tend to focus only on negative aspects of the groups they are protesting. You don't hear protests that are saying, "Way to go, guys, well done," but only, "You're a mess, clean up your act." That's fine, and a genuine activism is an important part of any authentic culture. But we don't want to focus only on negative or devolutionary aspects of society. We want to watch out for and be sure to include the positive and evolutionary forces that are also occurring in any culture around the world. This alone will give us a truly integral, balanced, and accurate picture.
All right.
Thank you, Ken. Looks like we've got a bit of time for Q&A, if you have time.
Yeah, if you want to do some question and answers. Just one second.
Hey, Mark, just give me 60 seconds. I need to rearrange things as we move from presentation to Q&A, but it'll be very fast.
Okay. And I'm going to need to be situated closer to the speakers so I can hear.
Yeah. And I'll sit next to you. We'll get this set up.
That's it. Okay, people, Ken's going to do some Q&A in a minute. If you want to use the Q&A function rather than the chat box, that makes it much, much easier. And can you keep your questions concise? So conveying the questions to Ken, it really helps if they're concise. There's a really good one, but a very long one on there. So make the questions short, then it's much easier to pass them on. Can you open up the box for me? You should get on mute.
Ask him to unmute.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I can read out questions here for you if that helps, Colin.
Yeah, we're all right. We're ready. We are ready.
Okay, so top voted question, why would you measure climate change by GDP as opposed to loss of habitats, ocean heating, or polar ice? I think it's more of a sort of challenge to the measure of climate change by GDP.
Did you get that? Okay, why are you measuring climate change in terms of gross domestic product rather than loss of polar ice, devastation of various ecological habitats, basically just damage to.
I was giving it an example of gross domestic product simply because that was a measurement that the IPC gave, and it was indicating the costs that it would take to address all of those problems, including climate change and ice cap change and other changes that would cost a country and the world a certain amount of money to fix. And so it was simply saying in about 50 years, this is the amount of money that it would take to address all of these areas that need to be addressed. So I'm just using an IPCC number. It's fairly straightforward, and it does put in context the actual amount of damage that was being done, because you could translate that into the amount of money it would take to fix that damage. And their estimate was about 2% of gross national product is how much climate change would cost us. So.
Okay, thank you. You okay, Colin?
Ready.
There's another question here, Colin. What is the role of the individual in the evolutionary moment? Is the situation so complex that an individual perspective is overwhelming? What can we do as individuals, is how I read that.
Yeah, well, individuals can first educate themselves into the types of changing that are occurring in as we move forward. And of course, some of them are positive changes and some of them are negative or devolutionary. And the first thing you need is to be educated on what are the good movements forward, the evolutionary movements, and ones that should be supported, and then which are the negative or devolutionary currents. And those are ones that need to be addressed through activism or protest or some other form of social justice activity. But it does take individuals educating themselves on what the actual issues are so we can know how to specifically address those appropriately.
Thank you. Question here, can you please comment to the evolutionary impact this embodiment conference may have from an integral perspective?
Well, sure, that's exactly what I'm talking about, educating people, so that even when we have a type of social activism, it's appropriately educated and it's not focusing on just a devolutionary impact. And so in something like an embodiment conference, you're hopefully educating a large number of people on just what the facts are. and just which direction and what information they need to know in order to know how to proceed forward in a way that's going to be healthy and actually produce positive change and not just negative.
Thank you. So this one here is a little complex, but let's give it a go. Dear Ken, how do you think the high expectations of a society, especially USA and Western society, are playing a role in disconnection between human beings and the difficulties in building true and vulnerable relationships can be affected by that pressure, which ultimately forces us to live lives anxiety and with high achiever mask on? It's a pretty complex question. I just gonna whatever you like to take from that.
Yeah, read the beginning part of it again.
How do you think the high expectations of society are playing a role in disconnection between human beings and the difficulties in building true and vulnerable relationships?
The disconnect between society, if that is occurring, then that's another example of basically poor information driving the disconnect. And so what you want is an accurate education, an accurate amount of information coming from society to the individuals so that you won't get a disconnect. And that's a really extremely important issue right now, particularly because of the polarization that we're seeing in cultures around the world, which is an extremely strong and major polarization and is itself causing an enormous amount of disconnect, not only between society and individuals, but between groups of individuals and the societies themselves. So again, I think it comes back in a large degree to getting accurate amounts of information in terms of what's good or bad in culture, so we know exactly which way to move, as opposed to just this polarization into it's all good or it's all bad, which is what we tend to see happening. And that's just not true. As I tried to point out in just that very sketchy outlined way in my short talk, there are both good and bad things occurring almost all of the time. And you want to be aware of both of them, or you're going to simply contribute to the problem. You're definitely contributing to the problem if you're not finding both the good and the aspects of any particular movement.
And are you just a question for me, are you hopeful, Ken, about this polarization? It certainly feels like we're walking a tightrope sometimes at the conference, and sort of any deviation from that could be quite dangerous. This polarization is really the backdrop of whatever we're doing. So do you feel hopeful, or other people say there's going to be a civil war, it's just going to descend into chaos? How hopeful about a healing of that polarization are you?
Well, yes, whenever you address this polarization, all you can end up doing, one of the results of trying to address that polarization, is to simply aggravate both polarized camps. They get upset, they get more irritated, in the sense they can get more polarized. And so what you have to have is, from the start, an understanding that we want an integral approach to this. We want to realize that there are both positive and negative things occurring in any movement anywhere. And that understanding has to be part of the backdrop of whatever the conference is. It won't succeed completely, because the polarized camps, many of them will tend to stay polarized or become more polarized. But the only cure for polarization is some form of unity. obviously. And the only way you get some form of unity is by taking an integral approach that unifies. And so that's why you have to at least emphasize the importance of a unitary approach to these issues. And if anything is going to change anybody in a positive direction, it's going to have to be that unitary or integral approach. Otherwise, by definition, you just have polarization.
Yeah, we've been aiming to heal some of that as best we can. And I've also seen our social media person facepalming throughout your talk. She's slightly concerned there's going to be a huge shitstorm, basically, just by not being polarized on this. So we'll see what discussion gets started by this. I hope it will be positive. Right. Maybe a last question here then, Ken. What is the most important issue to address today? A big question. Thank you to, is it Elizabeth for that one?
Well, my belief, of course, is that nothing short of an integral approach is going to address these issues. I mean, the opposite of integral is divided or polarized or broken or separated. And the only object to all of those is an integral or unified approach. And so pointing out the integral aspects of all of these areas is to me the only way that we're going to move forward. If we continue this polarization or this separation or this disunity, that's simply it. Well, some people are talking about it leading to a civil war. And I think that's at least a possibility. I don't think we're going to end up going that far, but it's certainly in the theoretical realm of possibility. But all that means, all civil war means, is a disunity, a major disunity, a profound lack of integral approaches. And the only cure for that kind of civil war is finding the commonalities between the various polarized camps. And that means some sort of unitary, integral, unified approach. And that you think that's either possible or it's not possible. If it's not possible, then we are simply headed ultimately to civil war. If it is possible, all that means is that human beings, there is a common core to humanity and human beings. We can find ways to unify our differences, still have differences, but a unity in difference, not just a difference with no unity. And that's what integral attempts to do. It attempts to present a unified basis, but it allows differences in every area. And that's why I tried to emphasize, even on something simple, like is it evolution or devolution? Well, the answer is yes, it's both. But that does mean there is room for both. And so we want a unity in diversity. And that's the only thing that's going to bring us together. So let the various diverse polarized groups present their important partial truths, and then let us find a unity that underlies those various polarized possibilities. There's no other response to this in general.
Well, thank you, Ken. We've tried at the conference to have really genuinely diverse views presented at the conference. We have enough presenter slots to do that, different areas. And your maps are really key to the understanding of the whole team, actually. Daniela and myself have been students for years, and we've trained the staff in some of these developmental maps as well. You know, I think maybe the last thing to be said is just, you know, Ken for president. I think that's maybe the best place to end. We still have a couple of minutes. If there's any last comments you want to make before we wrap this up.
If Ken has any comments?
Yeah, any closing comments from Ken? We still have a few minutes. If he's not too tired, we still have a few minutes.
Sure.
No, I would just repeat that in this age of increasing polarization, that we need to counter that with viewpoints that are integrated. And without that combination of a unity in diversity, we're just going to continue spinning apart, it looks like. And of course, one of the major, this is a whole other area, but one of the major forces that has driven this polarization to such extremes has been the election of Donald Trump in America. And without picking sides, he has managed to polarize this country even more than it was. And he gives both sides reasons to adopt their most extreme views. So we have not just the left, but the extreme left emerging. We have not just the right, but the extreme right emerging. And this makes unification extremely difficult. And although there's a sense in which you can say Donald Trump has done some good things in terms of policy, and he's done some bad things in terms of policy, and basically just his personality is so narcissistic and so grandiose. He just drives a certain type of person completely insane. And then they get extreme and polarized in their view. And it might be that just as a political background, we're not gonna be able to have this unification until Donald Trump is out of office. And again, depending on the side you're on, you can argue that that would be good or bad, because there are some good things that he's done and those would stop. There are some bad things that he's done and those would stop as well. But it's provable that this wild polarization that we see in America started when he became president. And it's basically just given a carte blanche to both sides of the political spectrum becoming extreme. And I think that extreme polarization has been very bad. If you look at Jonathan Haidt's research on polarization, he looked at all the major opposing groups in this country, like male and female, rich and poor, and those types of polarizations. And then he also looked at left versus right. And what he found, just using an average scale of 0 being the lowest polarization and 20 being the highest, was that almost every opposing group in this country, like male versus female, or rich versus poor, or educated versus uneducated, they had a polarization of between 6 and 10 points. Then when you got to political left and right polarization, it was a stunning 18 points. So that's where the major polarization is coming from. It's from the left and the right. And that tends to infect almost every other theoretical area that we have. And so I think that's going to have to just calm down. And then one of the factors that I think we're going to need is to move more and more towards a type of parliamentary system so that we can get out of just this two-party yes or no, up or down, in or out type of separation, because that itself just leads to an enormous amount of polarization. But again, the only thing that brings together polarities is unities. That's just across the board the case. And so what I want to see is people still looking at integral views and seeing if an integral view doesn't somehow speak to both sides of their own polarities and show them how to bring them together into unified, integrated, integral presentations, because that's ultimately the only way out of extreme polarization.
Ken, this has been beautiful. I think I speak for everyone, say we thank you for your huge body of work and wish you well with any health issues you might have there. Thank you, Colin, for your help. Well, it's nice to see you again, Ken. And you know, Ken is known for being clever, but when I came to see him in Colorado, what most impacted me was the sort of huge care and love that Ken has. The you know, maybe in some of his more intellectual books isn't obvious, but that was what really came across to me. So I want to say that, and that's come across tonight, that heart. So much appreciated. We'll come back to you for the final word in a minute. Before I do, just to say to everyone, if you want to get the library of all the recordings, to take your time watching everything over the next God knows how many months, over the winter maybe, then do that before Monday, because it's 50%. It's much appreciated to us as well if you want to buy those recordings. The Facebook group, I'm sure there'll be discussion about this in the Facebook group. Let's see if we can keep it civil. And there's the breakout rooms afterwards if people want to talk to each other in what we call the coffee breaks. They continue. We've got loads of other good talks coming up. Jack Kornfield is doing one tonight. We have Stephen Kotler. There's just a whole host more speakers still to come over the next few days. Daniela, thank you for hosting. Anything I missed out there?
No, just there's like a couple of more coming in the next days, like Rick Hansen is coming and A.H. Almas. So if you want to geek out a little bit more, that is for you.
Okay, lots of love to Ken coming from the chat. And we're putting a book together of quotes of one sentence from each presenter. So I'm aware that I'm asking Ken Wilber for one sentence. Is there a final embodiment tip or final quote you want to leave us with, Ken?
The only cure for rapid polarization is unification or an integral view.
Beautiful. Ken, I love you. Thank you for the work. Colin, thank you for helping us out tonight as well. Bye-bye. Ken. Bye, Colin. Bye, everyone.